So what's the answer? Is it early, late, in between? Is it early showing late features, late showing early features, real, unreal, just someone's fantasy? What was your conclusion?
Our group thought it's early.
It's early? And what was the reasons for that?
Went through these criteria and also feeling about the gut feeling, and it's very logical to be Brahmans to ask those questions and explain accordingly.
Yeah.
And so we thought it could be early.
Okay. So you felt that there was a coherence.
Yeah,
it made sense. The structure of it made sense. Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, what's most striking about it. So there's quite a lot of interesting aspects of it, but what's most striking about it is the almost uncompromising insistence on that kind of investigation, that continual inquiry, that not being satisfied with easy truths. Yeah, and to me, that's something I in my life only hear from people who are really good spiritual teachers. Yeah, or have a lot of wisdom. I don't hear that from the makers of cults or something like that, right? From them I hear, believe, you know, I'm right, you're wrong. Yeah? So to me that's one of the most strongest signs of authenticity of the Buddhist text as a whole. And there's, you know, other suttas, another Majjhima Nikaya sutta called the Vimamsaka Sutta, where the Buddha actually gives a whole criteria. Let's see if I can find it. It's quite an interesting one. The Vimamsaka Sutta. Okay, so not a great translation, but anyway, a bhikkhu who, anyone who can understand somebody, read somebody else's mind, then they should examine the Buddha thus, right? So he's saying that if you've got the ability to read people's minds, you should look at what I'm doing and test me. Is he really enlightened or not? You should examine when he has eye consciousness and ear consciousness, does he experience defilements resulting from his eye consciousness and ear consciousness, and so on. And then keeps on going through. They should make a further examination, and then should make a further examination. And then they, when a monk says that about the Buddha, then they should examine the monk. And then it keeps on going on and on and on with all these questions. And it's quite an astonishing thing to find. I mean, when do you have a teacher who taught in that kind of way, right? I mean, I've had teachers who said, you know, question what I'm saying, don't take it for granted, okay, but they don't sort of give a whole lesson on a detailed way of examining everything that you're doing and say, pick me up if I even get wrong on the slightest thing, right? I find this quite astonishing. But anyway, so that to me is one of the marks of authenticity of the Chanki Sutta. Anybody else from any of the other groups? We should hear something from each of the groups.
And then we felt that Buddha was trying to, at the early stage, of having to convince a lot of the Brahmins of this. Learnings.
That's another interesting and quite important point. In Buddhist scriptures, in all the later Buddhist scriptures, right? Everything after the early Buddhist texts, almost all of it is Buddhists talking to other Buddhists. Almost everything. And in the early texts we find very, very frequently the Buddha and the other Buddhists talking to non-Buddhists, right? And that's a very powerful sign that this was happening. This was the first generation. They were surrounded in a culture of people who were skeptical, who didn't believe them, and they had to establish that sense of authenticity. Only a couple of generations later, it wasn't, we have to establish our Buddhist authenticity, authority against Brahmanical authority, but the question was, how do I establish the authority of my school of Buddhism against the authority of another school of Buddhism? Yeah? So, and that's the kind of conversation which was being had. Yeah.
Support of that we thought was that there were no other Buddhist
disciples
in the story, which is often you will find that
that
Buddha has other
of his followers. I'm not sure what's the significance
that he was in a group that didn't include his followers.
Okay.
And often in other teachings he has them in his group, or they're in the story somehow.
So in a sense he's it's kind of getting out there, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's much more comfortable to be with your own students who are going to listen to you and stuff. It's a bit more.
Maybe, but that, it might be early on because there's not so many followers.
Oh, maybe there's not so many followers, yeah. Yeah, could be, yeah. It's hard to say. It's not entirely clear. Sometimes in the suttas, sometimes what you happen is that halfway through the sutta, you know, maybe the Buddha refers to Ananda or one of the other monks or something like that, and you realize actually that people were there, but they just weren't mentioned. So yes, but it could be the case, but it's a bit hard to be 100% certain. Yeah, Wendy.
I was just thinking about this is me just reflecting now rather than just in the second group. It could have been so early on that was straight up there his awakening because he had a reputation.
Uh-huh.
So it must have been maybe not when he was O Lordy O Lordy, but some stage where he had enough notoriety to be known, but not so much that he was O Lordy Lordy.
Right, yes. Yeah. That's a good point. And in the suttas, usually, you have the Brahmanical tradition is obviously a much older tradition, so that was a kind of an orthodox tradition to some degree. But you also had all the Shramana teachers, Mahavira, and from the other heterodox religions. But they are all said to be older than the Buddha also. So the Buddha is a kind of the young one. And he's actually criticised. I mean, it's kind of ironic, but he's actually like the young students sort of criticised for speaking in front of the elders. Then the Buddha is in fact criticised in the same way, right? For speaking over the top of the elder Brahmins and these kinds of things. Not speaking over the top of them, but for not respecting their authority. And so that's there's only a window there, isn't there? Right. In the first few years, no one had known who the Buddha is. Yeah, then he gradually develops a reputation. But then, certainly by the time of Ashoka, he was the great world teacher. Yeah, so it would have been much harder to depict him as being just one teacher with a group of other teachers speaking more or less as equals. So yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah. Okay. What other groups do we have that haven't spoken yet? Whose groups haven't said any feedback? We haven't had all of them.
If Sherry in our group picked up print something to do with the translation, probably where there's a reference to his or her, which we found a little bit out of context for the early teachings, but it could be very much in the translation.
Okay. Wait, what's the actual phrase?
It just says he/her.
Ah, so his slash her. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very doubtful that it actually says his slash her in the original text.
And you got a TTI, it might have been. Ajahn, maybe you put it in
the TTI. No. It could be. Sometimes you get cases where. In Pali, generally speaking, has a fairly heavily masculine bias, right? The default gender is pretty much the masculine gender, and most words, even words which theoretically could be neuter words, most of them are, so they have masculine, feminine, neuter genders, but the most of the neuter, most things which are actually not gendered are in fact masculine gender anyway, right? So it has quite a strong masculine gender bias. But there are some cases where you can express something in Pali and it will in fact be neutral. It won't indicate a gender just because of the syntax, whereas it's difficult to express that in a non-clumsy way in English without implying a gender. So perhaps that was the case that they were just trying to capture the fact that the Pali didn't specify a gender in that case. Yeah. There are a few places where it will say things like your bhikkhu wa bhikkhuni wa, you know, should any monk or nun do something like that. So a few places where it's kind of gender neutral, but it's fairly rare.
Yeah. It's quite funny the context it appears in, because it's all he, that,
okay.
All of a sudden he's her, and then he again.
Okay.
And it's sort of It must just be the translation.
Must be a translator's quirk, yeah.
So in that case, it might be the word, you can go back to the word and understand whether
it's been
translated or correctly translated.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually another question. The title that another person calls someone by giving them bad advice. And it makes you wonder whether it's in fact a fact or not. It's sort of. So really indicates something about the Buddha seeing the suffering that can be perpetrated by the ideologies and the satisfaction of others holding positions of power in society and spouting as though they have the truth, but in actual fact they bind people up and almost bind them up in a delusion that doesn't prove them, and it just leads to their people being caught in their own suffering.
Okay, so do we have, I'm not sure if have we heard from all the groups now? We've heard from most of them.
I'm just wondering, the Buddha actually scolded
somebody, and it was very direct, and it was very direct. Yes, it was very direct. I mean, a few people in different groups did mention that about the scolding, but to me the scolding part of it didn't seem, I mean, it was pretty mild. He just said, you know, shush you while the elders around. But what seemed to be more striking to me was, again, just too many tabs here. I'm trying to find the actual thing. Okay. What's much more striking was the whole thing about the very direct way that he challenged the Brahmanical authority. You know, I mean, that's pretty, it takes a lot of confidence to do that, right? You know, and he says, with regard to the ancient hymns of the Brahmins passed down through oral transmission, including their canon, their Pitaka, that would be, the Brahmins have come to the definite conclusion that this true, everything else is worthless. Moghamanya. Alright? What do you say? He says, well, is there any one Brahmin who says, I know I see this, only this is true? He says, no. Even a teacher or teacher's teacher? No. So this is the kind of Socratic method, right? You lead somebody on through question and answer to believe, realize that they actually believe something that's completely the opposite of what they thought they believed at the beginning of the time. And then it comes to even the ancient seers of the past. So this is really challenging. I mean, okay, fair enough to say my teachers are just passing down the tradition and they didn't see it. Even that's hard enough. But then you say that even the ancient seers of the past, okay, that's pretty, pretty challenging. And then you've got the role of blind men.
I can't quite follow what it is that they've passed on that they haven't experienced themselves. When the Buddha went to his initial teachers and moved on, they had reached a certain stage themselves, each of them, and they were not claiming to have gone beyond that stage. So
yeah, that's a good point, yeah. There's probably... Okay, so what are we talking about where they say... What kind of claim is being made here, right? Now, in what they're talking about, of course, is the Vedas, primarily the Rig Veda. Rig Veda is a collection of hymns which are homage to gods and so on. And so, I guess one implication of this would be, have they seen the gods, right? Do they know that the gods are real? So do they have any kind of psychic abilities or any special powers and so on? Now, I think that the Brahmanical tradition itself is very varied. It's not just one thing, right? And so, if these were more, Chunky is this kind of rich Brahmin landlord, you know, he's probably actually living a very worldly life and much more concerned with those things. So they might not have actually had a lot of connection with others who are Brahmanical contemplatives, right? Who had actually left the home and they were living in a remote hermitage and they were practicing. So I think perhaps, you know, I think it's a kind of very interesting point. Perhaps there were some Brahmins somewhere else who were actually having deep states of meditation and union with Brahma and all of these things, yeah? So they might have given quite a different answer. Yeah. So that's just to give you an example of some comparative study, text critical analysis. And as I mentioned before, just to recap some of the main points that we made today, that that when we're doing the text critical study, then the purpose of what we're doing is not to, just not to destroy. We're not out to smash the suttas into pieces, right? We're not out to prove how clever we are, like the Brahman student there. We're trying to understand the Dhamma better, okay? Because when we read the suttas, there are, as the Buddha himself said, there are many points which are unclear. There are many things which are doubtful. Yeah? And sometimes we might tremble in our faith, right? We might think, what's going to happen? I'm going to destroy my Buddhism. The Dhamma's going to destroy. On the other hand, maybe we might increase our faith. Maybe we don't get a lot of faith from reading stories about the Buddha flying through the sky and miracles and water and fire everywhere and stuff. And maybe we think that kind of stuff's all a bit, not quite convincing. And we're actually quite relieved, and our faith is quite increased by seeing, well, there's something grounded, there's something realistic, there's something human about what lies at the basis of the Buddhist tradition. So, as we go on and as we deepen our engagement and our understanding of the suttas, ultimately leaving behind the text critical studies, which can help us to a certain degree, can help to clarify certain things and overcome certain doubts. By far, of course, the most important thing is what happens when we practice things, when we put things into experience. And I think we can all agree that there's something quite remarkably insightful and precise about what the Buddha's talking here in terms of how you arrive at the truth, right? That this, you arise at conviction, you visit somebody, you get close to them, you lend them an ear, you hear the Dhamma, you remember it, you penetrate and contemplate the meaning of that, then you come to an agreement through pondering those Dhammas, or an acceptance through pondering the Dhammas, then there's an enthusiasm, wanting to practice, putting forth energy, then you make an effort, and then finally you realize the truth. And so there's this kind of, it's quite a very beautifully expressed and phrased process there, which is actually it's actually a very kind of solid piece of knowledge and very convincing and very encouraging something. It's giving you something that you can do, which sounds very realistic and which actually is leading towards the truth. So ultimately, the truth is the truth, right? The truth is it doesn't. What you do about it doesn't really matter. And by reading and studying the suttas, we go beyond them. Yeah, we don't stick with those things, just like in that process. It's not just, yes, you figure out what the suttas say, and then you figure out what their meaning of them is, and that's it, right? That's not what it's saying. It's saying that's the beginning, and then we go on. We realize that actually these are talking about something real. It's talking about an actual... It's talking about suffering. It's talking about the problems that I have, and it's giving a way out. Yeah. So let's put forth some effort. Let's do some meditation. Let's put these things into practice. And as you do that, the more and more that you do that, the more that you'll see that it really does lead to results. That these teachings do lead in the way that the Buddha describes. So that's it for today's workshop, the second workshop in the early Buddhism course. For next month, we're going to be starting to look in more detail at the content of early Buddhist teachings, starting with Buddhist teachings on ethics. Okay, so the first Sila Samadhi Panya, ethics, meditation, wisdom, and we'll be looking at the teachings on ethics next week. So, until then, thank you all for coming and thank you for your attention. And make sure you do your homework, otherwise you'll be very naughty and you'll get reborn as a black lizard for 7 lifetimes. I just made that up. Okay, let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.
Aham Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivadi Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamma. paripanno bhagavato sa.